Today on the Rise of the Challenge podcast.
What happened was I started modeling a lot in college, and school became a very low priority because I was off in Miami or LA or this or that. And slowly but surely, I just started to kind of pigeonhole myself into more bikini than lingerie, than I'm working for Playboy. And I went down that path. And all said and done, I'm out of that world. I have an in with NBC Tony Pavlovsky in Denver. And the first thing they say is, you worked for Playboy, you're never going to work in this industry.
Welcome to the Rise of the Challenge podcast. Joining today, she's a former Playboy model, teacher, and TEDx speaker. It's Joe Weatherford. How are you doing today, Joe?
I'm so good. Thanks for having me on.
We're so excited to have you on the show to talk about your rise to the challenge. What we like to do with all of our guests is go right to the beginning. Talk about where you're from and what you like doing growing up.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I grew up in a small town that's not so small anymore, Prescott, Arizona. Like, everybody knows about it now, but when I was there, nobody knew about it. It's very, very small. And when I was little, I really loved being outside. So nature was kind of my sanctuary, and I was an only child. So I was alone all the time, just kind of playing in the forest. It's funny because I was just in Arizona last weekend and I was remembering that. But that nature has always been my medicine, I guess. So I love to be outside. I love to play sports. I loved my friends.
With growing up in Arizona, everyone knows it as hot, heat, all that. Did that ever play an effect with being outside, or did you find ways to kind of enjoy the outside but able to manage that?
You know, it's interesting. So the town I was in is super high elevation. So we escaped the scorching heat of like Phoenix. And we had quite a bit of snow during the winters.
Oh, wow.
So it was actually the opposite. It was the cold that would trap us inside sometimes. But when I got older, I played competitive softball. So I remember being outside playing, and it's 120. It feels like, you know, you're in an oven. It's just horrible. You got catcher's gear on. It was awful. Cool. But yeah, thankfully growing up, I didn't have to deal with that.
You mentioned about the catcher's gear. When I played baseball, I was always the catcher. And Missouri heats are kind of the worst because it's like, it can be 70 degrees. Oh, but then it can be 100 the next day. And having equipment on was just the worst part. What did you love about softball?
You know, I was the pitcher primarily. I would catch when our other ones fainted. So, mainly I was... I was the pitcher and I was really good. I just had a natural talent for it. I worked with Ron Bolden, who also coached the Olympic team. So I got to train with a lot of girls that were playing in the Olympics when I was 12 and 13. So it was a magnificent experience for me. And I liked being the leader. I liked everything on me. You know, if I did a bad job, we sucked and lost. And if I did a good job, that put us in a good position. But I really did thrive under that pressure. And I don't know why, because I hate that kind of pressure in all other areas of my life. But when it came to sports, I was like, yeah, give me the ball every freaking time, you know?
Do you feel that same mindset carried over to where you are today? Did you kind of have that like love for having that competitiveness, that leadership aspect?
You know, where it did carry through is my speaking. So like, and really where I honed that talent was teaching. I was a professor for 12 years. And I mean, I just loved getting up and leading conversations. So it was kind of that same spotlight aspect. But what I loved about it is I could teach whatever I wanted. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I was talking about psychedelic therapy before it was popular or approved. Like when it was my class, I could come in with the topics that I felt were the most important. And that really was special. And I'm very thankful for the department that I worked for that gave me so much leeway. It's pretty insane. And we had a really good time together. So it was awesome. So that's one place I will say it carried over.
As you're growing up, did you have anyone that was a huge inspiration or a big motivator for you?
I did. I had several teachers that were phenomenal that could really see me. Actually, I wrote a poem in sixth grade, and my teacher submitted it to a national poetry competition that I ended up winning. And he didn't talk to me about it. He just did it because I would have talked him out of it. And it was really special. And yeah, Mr. LaRue, like I still remember him for seeing me and recognizing what I had done. And my softball coach was phenomenal, although I did burn out and start getting into trouble fairly quickly.
Uh-oh.
He coached me until I was 14 and really saved me from an additional few years of just angst and drugs and all of it. So I'm really grateful for him. So yeah, my coach, there were a few teachers.
Talking about that moment with burnout, did that lead into that direction of drugs and all that?
You know, I think the reality was the drugs were going to take over anyway. Like whether I was burnt out or not, nothing was going to stop my path into addiction. Like I did love softball. I was great at it. I loved my team, but yeah, nothing would have been strong enough, I think, to derail like my trajectory down that way. It was just once I really started drinking, once I really started using, that was game on.
Did the addiction change the path of sometimes we have that dream job that we were wanting? Did it kind of bring you into a different direction, or were you still managing to do both?
Oh, great question. Yeah, it severely altered my career path. So what I really wanted to do was be a broadcast journalist. And even in college, I was a broadcast major. I worked for a local NBC. I co-hosted a show Sunday mornings at 9, prime time. So I was literally probably going to make it if I just would have stayed committed and gone to a small market after I graduated, put in my dues, and done the deal. What happened was I started modeling a lot in college, and school became a very low priority because I was off in Miami or LA or this or that. And slowly but surely, I just started to kind of pigeonhole myself into more bikini than lingerie, then I'm working for Playboy. And I went down that path. And all said and done, I'm out of that world. I have an in with NBC Tony Kovlasky in Denver, and the first thing they say is, "You worked for Playboy, you're never going to work in this industry, ever. You will never do serious journalism." And it makes sense, right? Like, if somebody can go online and see me naked, they don't want me reporting on, the Gaza war, right? Like, it's just. I can say, well, that's not fair, but it kind of is, and I understood what they were saying, and so I had to drop that. But that was what I really truly wanted to do.
Was Playboy with modeling that end goal for you? Did you always plan on it? Or as you're taking each step in the modeling world, the opportunities just kept growing and growing, and that ended up being one of those opportunities for you?
Yeah, I mean, I never had any. I mean, I'd always modeled. Like, that was my first job. And it's really creepy looking back on it. I was 14 modeling wedding dresses, which is like,
Oh, wow.
now I think about it, I'm like, that's so weird. But I did. I liked modeling, but I never thought it would be anything that I did. I just thought it was something I did once in a while. And then as those opportunities started presenting themselves, and I mean, I had amazing contracts, and next thing I know, I'm traveling 230 days out of the year for a motorcycle company, just sitting there signing posters, and I'm at Sturgis and Bike Week, and I'm making stupid money. And then my addiction was so bad, I couldn't do anything else. Like, I was never going to get a regular job. I didn't even know what day it was half the time. So I needed an industry where not only was it okay for me to be drunk or high, it was encouraged. And so, It was kind of like the frog that slowly boils too. Like I definitely never thought I would be taking my clothes off for money, but it was this one time with this one photographer I shot a lot, and it was like, oh, let's just do implied. Oh, okay, the next one, it's a little bit more, and then it's a little bit more, and then slowly but surely, it's like, I don't even know what my standards are. I don't know how I feel about this anymore. I'm already so ashamed of everything I'm doing that, like, what's a little bit more shame? And you're going to pay me 10 grand? Cool, let's do that. I mean, it just really slowly but surely morphed into something that was so much bigger than me, you know, that had gotten away from me. And then I got used to the money, and I just knew there was no way I was going to be able to financially provide for myself in that way, you know, doing like a quote unquote real job.
Being part of a Playboy shoot, being involved in that world, did you learn anything different being in it than what kind of the perception is in the outside world?
Well, what I'll say about Playboy is back. I mean, this is a very long time ago. We're talking like 25 years ago, you know? It was really kind of this golden era. And at least for Playboy, I was treated with so much respect and dignity, and it was professional. Like, yeah, we would party on set, but there was a class and elegance to it that I don't think has existed in 25 years. Right when I got out was when we started to see girls not getting paid that just wanted to be a part of it. You know, like back when I was in it, it was a job. And I was high functioning enough to know I'm expected on set. I needed to look a certain way. There was, you know, nobody was hitting on you. The Playboy Mansion parties were phenomenal. Everything, it was just, there was an air of class to it. Now, I will also say the little bit that I did more in the Hustler and that kind of world, every single girl in that world was just trying to get out. There wasn't anybody that was like, oh my God, I've found my calling. It was, you know, anybody I talked to was just trying to get an exit strategy together to get out. And it was, I mean, it's kind of dark and insidious and like, ugh, energy. But what I will say is I've been sexually harassed way worse at like working at a golf course and working for an attorney's office, like way worse. You know, at least in that world, they're like, do you want to have sex? Nope. Okay. And then they move on. Nobody punishes you or won't hire you. So in that respect, it's actually a lot cleaner than the real world jobs that I've had.
Which is so crazy because we hear things about that world, and especially nowadays, what's been coming out. But like you mentioned, that the real world jobs were worse when it comes to that because those feel like those go under the radar until it comes out and makes public, or if someone's been in that world. So having that, you share that, it's so important because I think it could change the perception of what, like, people who weren't in it, what it went on. And I think it's so important that you're able to share that with the public and kind of give your perspective because you lived it. You went through it. As someone like for me, I'm only hearing what from the outsider, what people like you who actually lived that world.
Yeah, and I certainly, you know, I know that there are outliers, but I do believe that they are exactly that. They are outliers that had a great experience and loved it and everything else. But, you know, we're talking about addiction a lot in this episode, and we just have to mention it. Like, porn addiction is such a big thing, and it obviously primarily impacts men, but, you know, having been on sets and known some of the top performers in that industry, that shit is not real. You know, like, I don't know how much clearer to make it to somebody, but the damage that it does is. And it's not a moral issue. I'm so glad there are so many people talking about the impact of porn on the brain, on dopamine, on intimacy, because, you know, before anybody speaking out against porn had a religious undertone to it. And it's like that doesn't work for most people that are addicted to it. But when you start going, hey, this is what's really happening, this actually impacts your brain more than heroin, people are like, oh, You know, and it we just need to change the conversation from a moral issue to like, dude, if you want to fucking be happy, this is not the way to do it. And nobody escapes the consequences of it. It's just like it's a mechanism that is firing. So I don't know. And then we do get into, well, then how do you have intimacy and what do you believe about yourself? Because we can talk all day long about how that industry hurts women and women's body image and confidence during sex. But like men get wrecked by it. You know, if they can't go for an hour and they're not like 18 inches long, then they hate themselves and think they're bad at sex. And it's like, dude, nobody wants that anyway. But you don't know that because that's what you're watching, thinking that's the gold standard, and it's not. And it's really, I mean, it's really, really sad. And anyone can get addicted to porn. You know what I mean? Like anybody. You start watching it, and then the next thing you know, it's a way that you're soothing, relieving anxiety, and it becomes a habitual pattern. And then the dopamine, which is the motivation chemical, starts hooking you into those cravings, and then it will bleed out and impact all areas of your life. And it sucks to quit.
You kind of mentioned earlier about how you would never get a real world job because you were in Playboy or doing those types of photo shoots, but you were a professor and you were a teacher, which is definitely one of those that you don't see much when it comes to someone coming from the modeling world and Playboy to being a teacher. So talk about that transition and being able to kind of bet all odds and beat the system and be able to do that.
Well, thankfully, I was smart when I was in that industry and I never shot with the same name twice. I used different aliases. I didn't want to be famous and I knew someday I wouldn't be doing that anymore. I didn't want anybody to be able to find me. That was not my goal. Where I screwed up was, you know, being in some scenes with like very famous people. So my stuff, unfortunately, was out there. But I changed my name. I left that off the resume, you know, and my teachers and just got to know me through my master's degree, and they knew who I was. They knew what I brought. I'm sure they knew I had a really checkered past, but they didn't ask, and I really appreciate that. They didn't hold my past against me. So thankfully, nobody knew. I don't think I would have been hired, and I was so ashamed of it, but more than that, I was terrified that somebody would find out because I didn't want my students, especially my, here I am teaching 18-year-old males, you know, and I'm already only 5 to 6 years older than them. That was my nightmare. I was so terrified someone would find out. And thankfully they didn't, and I had a great relationship. My students really respected me. I mean, I hate that when I talk about being a professor and people just instantaneously like, oh, I bet the guys loved you. And I'm like, dude, the guys and the girls love me because I was a solid instructor who genuinely cared about them and talked about real shit with them. And I wasn't bad to look at, but that was not a part of my interaction with my students ever. And I never talked about it until recently. Recently, I was working with a business coach who's like, that's an interesting part of your story. You should talk about it. And now that I don't teach at the university anymore, I'm like, well, you know, now I do think I have something that I can contribute from that. Like, I don't want to share that story just to share it, but if there's something of value that I can add through it, then I'm happy to talk about it. But it really was such a small part of my life. But I mean, it was impactful. It changed my life forever, for sure. But I'm very, very fortunate that I was able to make that transition because a lot of women aren't. And they get very stuck in it. And getting sober is what saved me. You know, that's why I was able to rebuild, redefine, and redirect.
Leading into that, when was the rock bottom where sobriety was that next step that you needed to take?
You know, I got sober when I was 24, and that's what got me out of the industry. And I never did hard drugs again, but I did start drinking again later, and I didn't realize how bad alcohol was for me. Like, I deep down I knew, but I still wanted to pretend and believe that I could drink. And it's so dumb. I remember thinking, there's no way I can't have champagne on my wedding. It's like the it was just like this thought I had, and it really kept me sick. And so I when I'm working with people, I look for those, the yeah buts, right? I know I need to stop drinking, but I couldn't possibly not have champagne on my wedding day. And it's so dumb, but I swear to God, that stupid thought took me out. So I started drinking again when I was in graduate school, and it didn't last long, thankfully. I had a really horrific experience. I was raped in a hotel in Tampa. But actually, it was the thing that got me sober. It was the first time that something really bad had happened to me, and I felt compassion for myself. And so that like opening, just a little bit of this wasn't my fault, and I'm sorry this happened to you. Like that was kind of my inner dialogue. And then I was like, I don't want to drink anymore. Like I really want to take care of myself. And so it created an opening. And then I went to the only treatment center that did aversion therapy in the world. And it was Schick-Schedel Hospital in Seattle. And I mean, it was horrific. You go in, you get injected with something that causes flu-like symptoms. Then you drink a water glass full of Ipecac, which if you have kids, you know that's what you give to people when you want to make them throw up. And you're supposed to give them a tablespoon. And I drank a water glass of it. And then you just start pounding drinks and you're vomiting for like 20 hours. It is hell.
Oh.
But it worked. I was there 10 days. And this was almost 12 years ago, and I've never wanted to drink again. It just totally took it away. And it's so sad it closed. And so that's kind of one of my missions. I'm still in contact with the nurses, the staff. I would love to find an investor to open one, because treatment rates are dismal. I mean, like, it's awful. When I went, there were like 20 of us. Five of us are still sober over 10 years later. That's unheard of. And a lot of people got a lot of years back. So I really hope there is a way that we can get that up and running again because it was unique. It was one of its kind.
A big challenge that people going through addiction is being open with their loved ones or people that they talk to about those things. How was that journey for you? And comparing to going through sobriety, telling those same people about your new journey or that new journey that you were going on from addiction.
You know, I really didn't carry anybody from my old life into my new one. I mean, I just didn't. But what I will say is the people that were close to me at that time, like I wasn't in a relationship, but they were happy for me. Like they knew I needed to get better. It was very easy. And what I will say is if you're somebody listening to this right now and you're like, oh my God, I know I need to get help, and this is a hard conversation to have, the people that are around you know. Like you may be in denial, but nobody else is. Like it's very clear when you're at that level of addiction, I don't care what substance or lifestyle, you know, addiction that you're dealing with, the people know. And it's really fascinating. I was just thinking about this topic a lot. You know, alcohol has such a negative impact on relationships. Not for everybody. I know tons of people that drink and it does not negatively impact their life. So I'm not saying that it's bad for everyone, but the people that have even an inkling of a problem with it's a big problem. And spouses are walking on eggshells when you're drinking. They're terrified that you're gonna fuck up some family event. You know, it's they're worried, like, oh God, you know, how bad is this going to get? So people are already having that internal dialogue, whether they're discussing it with you verbally or not. So that cannot be the barrier. It's like it's already happening. You know, now whether or not you are going to do anything about it, that's
Yeah.
a separate discussion.
It's crazy that people who are looking from the outside that are close to you pick up on those things or pick up on signs so quickly. But when people they tell that person, have you been doing anything differently? Have you been like, it's just like that person goes into in denial mode and says, oh no, that's not me. I'm not going through it. But when you now reflect on that, it's like, wow, they did pick up on those signs quickly and did not even realize it. So it's so opening that you say that, because things that I've gone through in my challenges, it's like people pick up on quick and it's like, how? Like, where was that first time that you thought, did I go through that?
Right. I kind of think about it like when we're in it, we've got our nose right up to a painting, right? And all we see is blobs. And it's not until we get enough away from it that we can actually see the whole picture. And I was recently humbled in this area. Working in the mental health field for 12 years, being sober, I mean, I definitely know never claim to have it all together. I am absolutely a work in progress, but I didn't realize how bad my codependency was. And this is something everybody else very much saw. And for me, I didn't see it until a relationship ended. And then it was that like just unbelievable grief and terror and all of it that I was really forced to look and acknowledge and recognize. And I mean, this was very recent, and like I teach this stuff, So I have a lot of compassion for people that are like, no, I'm good. It's like, are you though? Because this is very, very difficult. And I go, man, was that denial? Or was I just so like I was just in my beingness to such a big level? Like, that's just how I love, and that's just how I show up, and this is just what I do. It's not a disorder. There's nothing wrong with it. I'm just being me, And yeah, man, it's crazy. And now I look and I'm like, who was that person? So it is. It's a very, very interesting process. When other people see it, we don't. Then when we see it and they see it, and then there's the we do something about it stage.
I want to go
Hopefully.
in, want to go into certain different topics, reflection, mental health, and all those things, because you kind of mentioned it going into it. And us having conversations prior to this interview, we kind of know a little bit about, I know a little bit about that journey that you've been on. So social media has been able to let you reflect in that path, your path that you've been on. How has that played a big part in your journey, and that specific relationship has changed your new chapter that you are on?
It's really fascinating because that relationship, it was really precious in a lot of ways. So I was married. I was in a relationship with my ex-husband for 10 years. So we divorced. It's nasty. It's awful. It's just a nightmare. And 3 months later, I jump into a new re relationship with somebody that had been my friend for over a decade. So there was a level of comfort there. There was a level of connection that I felt really safe. And he is a good person. He has a good heart, and I do believe really cared about me. So my desire to not deal with everything else that was happening, and for him to be a lifeline for me during that time, to support me, to be a comfort. The way he showed up, it wasn't just about finally getting my needs met because my ex-husband was very cold, very cut off. So here's this person. He shares my love language. He's very, very, very touchy-feely, and his words of affirmation is just my jam. It was everything I had been neglecting, and then it gets poured into me, and I just went too fast. And the thing about it was, it served a beautiful purpose because what happened was, at the very end of it, I learned a lot of things that were very heartbreaking for me. I had to really look and see and acknowledge the red flags that I blew through. I had to be very honest about how I showed up. And how, in some ways, I was extremely selfish too, because I just needed to get my needs met. So there was kind of this agreement, a silent agreement to take advantage of one another. And I fell in love with the fantasy, but the fantasy is never sustainable. And there were a few times where he really showed me who he was, and I decided to look past it. And so one of the big things I was really mad about was the objectification of women. And yet here I was objectifying him. I didn't fall in love with him. I fell in love with the fantasy. And so when that came apart, it also coincided with one of my family members who I love very much, who's been sober for 13 years, relapsing. So two of my most important connections unraveled and I snapped. There is just no other way to say it. I didn't even think it was possible for me to snap at the level that I did. And it's never happened while I was sober. So it was a pretty scary experience. And I'll tell you, I'm fortunate that I was able to do this, but I went to the forest. Like I left Cabo, I went to the forest to really ground, be in nature, which I love. And then I didn't leave my house for 30 days. Like I sat down and I meditated and I was like, I'm not leaving this room until I'm better. I don't know what that means. And it was crazy. I didn't eat, I couldn't sleep. I dropped 20 pounds. It was like the darkest night of the soul I've ever experienced. But I was like, I'm going to sit here and deal with this pain until I'm better. Like, I was going to go to a retreat in Nicaragua and I was going to, oh, I'll get on these dating apps. I'll just meet somebody else. Like, we all have our things, right? I know how to distract myself and get myself out. And I was like, no, don't for once. Go within and just sit in it. You know, that's one of the biggest things I teach people to do. So I made myself do it and it was absolute hell. I mean, I really, by the day 30, I was just praying to God. I'm like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I was literally going to have to check myself into a hospital. It was so bad. And at that moment, it kind of started lifting. But it gave me that chance to really be with my inner child and that little girl and, you know, deal with the abandonment I felt as a kid and my parents' addiction, the enmeshment that I have with my mom, like so much shit that I've talked about it, but I've never dealt with it. Like it's been an above the neck experience. It was like in my mind, I figured it out, right? But my heart was still broken from it. And so I mean, it was a crazy, gnarly experience. Anybody that has anxiety, I didn't realize that anxiety and depression could coexist. And that is gnarly. Like sheer terror just radiating through my body, paired with hopelessness and despair. And I was just like, oh shit, I didn't think it was possible for them to coexist like this. You know, usually I've been one or the other. No, it was awful. So I really, anybody that has gone through that experience, I feel for them. And what's interesting is my ex-husband was in that state for a very long time. And I actually felt compassion for him. I really did. I was like, oh my God, this is what he was explaining to me all of those years that I couldn't get. And I was just like, dude, get your shit together. We have an amazing life. Like, I'm an awesome wife. We live in a $1 million house. You work 10 hours a week doing something you love. Like, what do you have to complain about? You know? And then I could feel what he was talking about. And I went, oh, yeah, that is miserable. So it was a humbling experience, to say the least.
Do you see how you mentioned earlier that nature was kind of that place that you felt at home? And you just recently just said that being in nature kind of helped you in the process with healing and kind of reflecting. Did you kind of ever have that kind of full circle moment that nature is that kind of that healing spot for you?
Yeah, I've really grown to appreciate nature as like the mother, you know? And so that has being in nature, grounding, really appreciating all that the earth gives us, that reciprocal, beautiful, symbiotic relationship I try to have with her. I've always, well, I shouldn't say always. Recently, that's been a big part of my journey. And when I moved to Cabo, I had never lived on the beach before anywhere. I started noticing that every single day I would go and get in the ocean, even if it was 10 minutes. I would go and get in the ocean, and when I would put my feet in the sand, I felt better. It was almost like standing on one of those grounding mats, you know, and I would put my feet into the earth and I could literally feel myself coming online. So I'm well aware of the benefits. And I really think that that's important for people to know, like, we want to get real fancy with all the biohacking and, you know, tell me what to do and how do I feel better. I mean, I will say my therapist that helped me through that time, what worked was back to basics. It was mineral salt baths twice a day. It was getting outside barefoot and getting my heart rate up. So walking up a hill, you know, even if I couldn't work out or run or anything, but being outside, it was eating grounding food, you know, like squash and soup. And, you know, she's like, no smoothies, no salads, like rooting into myself. It was journaling, it was meditation. It was, you know what I mean? It was just the simple things. And I really didn't want to go and reach for something outside of myself to make me feel better. So there wasn't a retreat, there wasn't a plant medicine ceremony, there was nothing. It was like, dude, save yourself for once, do this alone. And and it was those back to basic things that kind of helped my nervous system start regulating. And as I started coming back online, I could do them more and better and longer. And then finally I just was in my routine and kind of back in the world. But it was a real simple list. Do this, you'll feel better.
When you mentioned the being on the beach and kind of getting in the water, to me, I'm in the Midwest, so we don't have access to a beach anywhere. But when I go on vacations, I always tell friends, family, I'm like, I got to be somewhere where water is, because I feel that it's kind of like a reflecting, it kind of resets me, it kind of gets me in a better mindset to kind of just be in the moment. So anywhere I go, beach, Florida, California, North Carolina, like I will go to those places because I feel at home. I'm always like, I should be living by the water, but I'm stuck in the Midwest, the kind of mind.
Yeah, there's something magical about it. And again, I had a really deep calling in 2020. You know, I knew everything was going to change from that moment on. And it really did. That's when I stopped teaching, sold a business, sold everything I owned. We moved down to Mexico, and I knew wherever we land, I need to be by the ocean. It was just, and it wasn't just because of the physical beauty. It was like a deep knowing. It was like a magnetic pull, like I need this. And it is truly spectacular. I mean, I will say, just looking outside and seeing the water, I feel better. It's a very, very noticeable shift.
When you're not working, what does Jill like to do for fun? What are things that maybe people don't know you enjoy doing currently that might surprise them or maybe pique interest for them to try?
You know, I'm a creature of habit. I mean, obviously I'll do some like random crazy things like sell everything, move to a foreign country. But my days pretty much look the same. Like I really do. I enjoy meditating. I enjoy that stillness. I really enjoy working out. I enjoy yoga. That's always a big part of my day. I love going to the gym. If you don't love going to the gym, try something else. There's 8 jillion different types of things you can do, you know, play tennis or bar classes, or there's really no excuse at this point. Like there's so many options, but move your body. One of the things I love, the people who know me are not surprised, but people that don't know me might be. I love going and dancing at raves. Like I'm an excellent shuffle dancer, and I love being just with the music and the crowd, and like the DJs that are really good. I mean, they just turn your body into a speaker, and the music and the vibration is just so uplifting. I love it. It tends to be, you know, people aren't drunk. They're interacting with one another. They're happy. It's just like it's a really, really powerful thing. So I make sure I'm including that in my routine, and I do. I love to dance. The other thing is I love reading murder mysteries.
Oh.
I'm like a huge reader. I'll be read like three or four books in a week sometimes if it's an author I really love. I mean, I can read a book start to finish in a couple of days, and I'll go on these binges. So reading, not like self-development books, but just trashy murder novels is something I really enjoy.
With the journey that you've been on, what's been the biggest thing it's taught you? And do you see any of the challenges you face really playing an effect now to where you are today? Or do you feel that it's taught you so much that it's continuing to help you grow to become the better version of yourself?
Yeah, I mean, when I was younger, I didn't know how to use pain as an opportunity. I knew I was in it and I hated it. And yes, all those experiences shaped me for sure, but I was in extreme resistance to them. So it was very, very challenging. Like it, the benefits didn't come for many years later. Now, even when I'm in excruciating pain, like I just recently was, I know that it is serving me. Like I genuinely, with all of my heart, believe that everything that comes into my life or leaves, there is a purpose and it is working for my highest and greatest good. And so what I didn't know back then that I know now is this pain is serving me. And that's actually a mantra. This pain is serving me. And so even though I was in the depths of hell, and I will tell you, I was genuinely scared. Like my nervous system snapped. I was so dysregulated. I could intellectually understand what was happening, but I was spiritually, emotionally, physically, like it wrecked me. So having that innate knowing, though, that this is serving me and it's what needs to happen allowed me to not be in resistance to it, in addition to being in it. Because usually it's like meta emotions, right? It's not just the shame that we feel, it's how we feel about the shame that we feel. So it's the same thing. A lot of times it's not the problem that's happening, it's how we feel about the problem that's happening. So like really being able to go, as awful as this is, I believe that this is necessary for my evolution. That is the key. I really honestly believe that.
The final question I'll ask you for someone that's listening to this interview based on your journey and experience, what tips or advice would you give them to overcome obstacles, accomplish their goals, and rise to the challenge?
So it's twofold. When you're in a good place, capitalize on it. When you're feeling good, when life is going well, do a lot around gratitude and being thankful because it's easy. You know, like we don't typically grow, we don't evolve when things are good because we don't need to. So what we want to do then is like fill that cup, you know, whether it's love, gratitude, like really staying in that energy, like letting our body memorize the experience of what it feels like. And the flip side, when things are going bad, use that to your greatest advantage. What is this here to teach me? Who am I going to be at the end of this process? How is this serving me? And never wasting that opportunity, like be all in the process, you know? And that is the opposite end of addiction. Addiction is give me this thing, I can't handle it. It's like, no, sit in it. And practice, you know, when things come up and they're just mildly irritating, that's the place to practice instead of being like full-blown triggered, typically by somebody you love. That's where we're gonna snap, right? And it's like using moments always of how can this soften my edges? And like playing with life is the other thing too. You know, I remember one night I was actually in an Armin van Buuren concert, and I was like, what is the point of life? What is the point of life? It has been coming to me a lot, that question. And then all of a sudden, it was like, oh, we're here to play. Like, we are here to experience this life. You know, there's no winner, no loser, no right, no wrong. We're just here to be it. And if we really believe that God splits into a billion fractals and wants to know itself, and we're all here as that energy getting to know itself, then all of a sudden it's like, oh, we're here to play. You know, we're here to grow. We're here to evolve. We're here to love. We're here to fuck up. We're here to grieve. We're here to know who we really are and do our best to live in that authentic truth, you know, and really not allowing people to define that for you. I mean, that has been a big part of my journey. I am such a dichotomy. People never know what to do with me. They're like, it's weird. You're this and you're that. I'm like, yep. And it's fun, you know? And I don't know. So I really hope everybody can just be that unique expression because that is what makes things interesting. And you won't be everybody's first choice or even 100th choice. And you're not supposed to be. Like, you're not here to be liked, you know? You're here to live that authentic expression. So, yeah, that's my that's my rant about that.
Well, Joe, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about your rise to the challenge. You're inspiring so many people, and we are excited to see what the future looks like for you.
Thank you so much. So am I.
Tune in next time to hear my next guest talk about their rise to the challenge. Remember to follow, subscribe on all major audio platforms. Make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel to get the latest episode in video format. What path do you take to accomplish your goals? You decide.